Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan.
And I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up on today's show, with rising rents in London and an increasingly isolationist turn in the UK, we speak to two designers with a space-saving solution for priced-out creatives.
What we wanted to do is create a little studio space, really affordable studio space, that could pop up in the city in many places. It can be either public spaces or private.
Just over a month into the Venice Architecture Biennale, we speak to the co-curator of the Nordic Pavilion to consider the event in the Veneto region more closely.
Next, these shirts are very loose-fitting, they're all cotton, they're very comfortable and casual, and I think basically any guy could throw them on and sort of feel very relaxed, and who wouldn't want to wear that on their holiday?
Monocle's Jamie Waters joins us in studio to give his pick of the three brands to watch this summer, from Mallorca, Buenos Aires and Gothenburg.
Plus, our Asia editor-at-large, Kenji Hall, tells us about the Japanese train designers scrapping speed for comfort. All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24.
Despite adding much to the economy and vibrancy of our cities, makers and creatives are often pushed to the edge of them due to the expense of renting or buying studios within them.
How can cities make space for makers and better balance the use of space? It's a question that architects Jonas Prishmontas and Tommaso Baano have thought through as part of the London Festival of Architecture. I pay them a visit to find out more about their space-saving project. People in the creative industries, like designers, architects and artists, need space. But space in areas with strong creative communities and industries like London is becoming more and more expensive, and it's not clear what people being priced out can do about it. Now, a team of designers has come up with a solution that might be able to save the creative classes from exile. Tommaso Boano and Jonas Prishmontas are the minds behind Minima Moralia, a tiny, modular studio designed to be easily erected in backyards and odd scraps of public land, as spaces for people to work without breaking the bank.
My name is Tommaso. I'm an architect from Italy, and I've been living here in London for 5 years. I'm now working with Jonas, and we are developing small-scale architecture to tackle problems in this city.
And my name is Jonas Prishmontas, and I'm from Lithuania. I've been here for 10 years. I came to London to study and sort of fell in love with the city. And now just, having fun working on a small-scale project with Tommaso.
You're an architect, and you've got an installation here for London Festival of Architecture.
Correct.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, London Festival of Architecture is a one-month-long event that takes place in London every year. And the theme of this year was really interesting. Was about communities. Was about the future of London, given the fact that London faces some problems like affordability, increase rent prices, and all things like this that kind of affect our life here.
So, how did you come up with the idea for this?
Well, we just wanted to build something for a friend of ours that had a backyard that wasn't used. So we thought, why don't we build something there that you can use all year long and you can use it to make your own art. You can make your own things there. And so everything started in this way, very easygoing. And then we thought this is actually cool. They can actually work, and we can replicate it in other places, and it can become a thing. The installation wants to investigate, basically, this problem of affordability for young artists. And this is just one of the many outcomes or one of the many projects that we can do to tackle this issue. In this case, what we wanted to do was to create a little studio space, really affordable studio space, that could pop up in the city in many places. It can be either public spaces or private spaces. In this case, we are showing our installation on the rooftop of Dawson Roof Park. It's been used by the artist of the Bootstrap Company, and we also hosted a couple of activities during this month of London Festival of Architecture. We are inside our installation, Minima Moralia. It's a little space that can host two or three people working, and is made by a steel frame that actually comes from desks that we collected from a school. These desks are combined together in order to create a three-dimensional spatial grid, basically. Like a naked structure, very simple and pure, kind of. This structure is ready to be filled with shelves or desks or boxes. The reason why we did that is because we wanted this space to be customizable. Like people are coming here and they need one or two boxes, or they want shelves, or they just need a little desk, so they can, you know, come here and inhabit this space according to what they need. Because it's an affordable space, we use things that are very simple and easy to find, to make, and to build. So these are just OSB boards, and the outside is just a cladding of polycarbonate sheets. We choose this because it provides a sort of level of transparency that connects the inside and the outside space, because you can see through, but you don't have a clear image of what is going on outside you. So this kind of highlights the intimacy of what's going on inside, but also provides enough lights, enough natural lights. And another characteristic of this space are the openings. So we have one side that can fold up and creates like a canopy that allows the artist inside this space to communicate his work. And so you kind of work on the threshold between the inside and the outside. So providing a sort of like exchange, you know, of what you are doing and what people outside can see. We thought that, you know, was really important to build something that was customizable, that was easy to make, and we actually made it. So we are architects, and we feel that it's our duty to learn and to do and to prove that you can build your own things. This is lots of fun, lots of work, but it's a good challenge, because in the end you feel that you've mastered every detail of this space, and you actually made it with your hands, and this is great. We really loved it.
Have you got any of these dotted around the place actually being used by people? And I also wonder, where do you see it fitting into a city in terms of who do you anticipate buying these? Where do you imagine them being placed? And how do you imagine them being fitting in to the regulatory framework of a city? It's so difficult to build permanent buildings and make them a particular way. Do you think this is something which people can approach more flexibly?
London is a city that changes very, very fast, right? So we like this concept of having something temporary that can work for 1 year, 5 years, 3 months. It's something that you can build quite quick. We also thought that the options that are like currently used by London to give new life to streets is just very limited. Usually what happens is that you want to give life to a street, a square, you just create a food market, which is really cool. It's really interesting. I mean, I love it. But we thought, like, why don't we integrate food markets with like spaces for artists? Like, why don't we give, I mean, more options, you know? This can work on the public level in this way, in abandoned spaces that they are not used, or it can also work on a private level. Like, you can have backyards of people that currently, I don't know, you have houses where everybody shares rent, kitchen, living room, and they all have a backyard. I mean, the housing, the typical housing typology here has usually a backyard. And if you think about how many times per year you use that backyard, it's not that often because of the weather, because of everything. So you just use it for barbecues, basically, in the spring or summer season. So we saw like a huge potential in these spaces. So these spaces can actually become something active that you can rent out, or you can give to artists and people that need space. So we like to, you know, have this sort of interaction between what is private, what is your house, what is your backyard, and what is public, like hosting someone that comes every day and do their own arts in your garden.
Minima Moralia is an intriguing, design-minded solution to a problem that can seem intractable. It shows that with enough creativity and resourcefulness, the creative classes in the likes of London and New York may be saved yet.
Next, we head to architecture's premier Italian showcase. That is, of course, the Venice Architecture Biennale. This year's show is directed by the Chilean Alejandro Aravena and has been underway for a month now. Plenty of time, then, for critics and professionals to consider the show's brief of reporting from the front and weigh it up against previous installments.
We turned to James Taylor Foster, European Editor-at-Large of architectural website Arc Daily and co-curator of the Nordic Pavilion at the Biennale, to get his view on how to think properly about a show of this length. James, thank you so much for joining me. The reason that I wanted to talk to you and revisit the Venice Biennale now is that we're just over a month in to a six-month-long event. So much of the coverage of the event is concentrated in the first week. You know, what's the metabolism of consumption for such a long show for you? Have you reevaluated any of the pavilions since it opened?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think you have to really go all the way back to 6 months ago from when it opened, which was when Alejandro Aravena, who is the director of this year's Biennale, selected a single photograph to brand this year's Biennale, but also to kind of embody his distinct approach, which he called reporting from the front. It's a photograph taken by Bruce Chatwin of the German archaeologist Maria Reich, and she's inspecting some of the Nazca lines in the Peruvian desert. She stood on top of a lightweight aluminium ladder, which she used as a tool to study the inscriptions of the ground, simply because taking a car around the desert would run the risk of destroying the lines. And Aravena saw this as an inventive solution, doing something with very modest means, which has meant that this Biennale has been about really listening to those who have been able to gain some perspective on things, people who are now consequently in the position to share knowledge and experience, and this idea of this kind of inventiveness, with those people who are standing on the ground. A really intelligent concept for a Biennale, an extremely ambitious concept for a Biennale, especially in Venice, which is, you know, one of the most, I don't know, exuberant cities in the world, one of the most wealthiest cities in Europe. And it has met enormous criticism as the Biennale, as the dust has settled. One particular architect, Patrick Schumacher, who was a director of Zaha Hadid Architects, who was Zaha Hadid's right-hand man, has basically said that architects are simply not equipped to address these issues. It's not the best value for our expertise. And he's not alone. Other people have been critical in a more measured way. Carson Chan, writing in Frieze magazine, said, I think he quoted a professor of geography from the University of Manchester, actually, a guy called Eric Swingedow, who basically has seen this Biennale as not really achieving what it initially set out to do, or at least what it was expected of it. He said, the problem is that the architecture discipline's age-old inability to discern between learning from a condition and intervening in it. So that is between its intelligence as an analytical tool and its very separate role as an agent of design just simply hasn't been met. And it's a major issue for me, which I think connects to the question, how do you present, let alone curate, architecture or architectural projects? And I think that after the intensity of the opening, you know, as you said, there's a very intense moment at the start, a very intense moment at the end, and lots of quiet moments of reflection in between, which is where we are now. Questions like this have been at the forefront of my mind as I've been visiting and revisiting the pavilions. For the ambition of this Biennale, which has really been about, I suppose, condensing all of architecture's very, very rich complexities in relation to social problems, engineering challenges, material innovation, they can't really be adequately expressed in conventional architectural methods. Models, be they of any scale, even full-scale models, they don't really do the job. Drawings don't necessarily do the job. And so the only way to do it is to abstract things, is to make bold statements that are immediately coherent and kind of belie depth or layers. Many have achieved this in some respect. I don't think anybody has achieved it into the same success that is often achieved in the Art Biennale. It's a very different beast, of course. But as the dust is settling, these fractures are becoming more and more evident.
James, you rightly point out that it's an extremely, well, explicitly political theme that's been set by Aravena for this Biennale, reporting from the front. Now, obviously, you know, we can't ignore the fact that since the Biennale began, the political context particularly within Europe, but really globally, has completely shifted because of Britain's vote to leave the European Union. How has the Biennale and the pavilions within it reacted, if you will, to this event? Has your interpretation of any of them or the event as a whole changed? Is the impact that they're having different?
It's a very, very important observation you've made. And I think that one thing has become abundantly clear, that the Biennale in general, and something which Paolo Barotta, who's the president of La Biennale, is finding himself defending more and more, it may be an interesting comparative tool to fill a series of national pavilions. But the old European colonial powers, I'm talking about Britain, France, Germany, Holland, Spain, Denmark, Austria, Hungary, and even the US, if you could categorize that in the same way, have a very powerful presence in the Giardini, which is the kind of primary national participation exhibition space of the Venice Biennale. These countries have enormous pavilions. They have large central exhibition spaces. Other countries are not so lucky. And year upon year, other countries are being slowly squeezed, you know, as more and more join the Biennale, slowly squeezed into the Arsenale or into the city at large. But, dare I anecdotally say, do not get the same level of visitors. And when you're stood, you know, along the, there's a kind of a road, a street, a pathway, which goes up called the Viale Trento. You have Britain, France, and Germany set at the top. You do think, what on earth is really going on here? And as the European Union has kind of started to completely fragment around us, or the very notion of it has kind of been called into question, the anachronistic Venice Biennale is becoming more and more of a reality. And visitors from around the world, people who are not necessarily in the architectural sphere, who are simply coming into this as curious observers, are noticing this immediately. And I think that's a question which, you know, the Biennale are going to have to address. They cannot simply sit idly by in the future.
That was James Taylor Foster, European Editor-at-Large for architecture website ArcDaily and co-curator of the Nordic Pavilion at the Venice Architecture Biennale, which runs until November.
Don't forget, you can hear an interview this month with the show's curator Alejandro Aravena on The Big Interview on Monocle 24, plus read our roundup of the show in the forthcoming September issue of Monocle magazine.
Still to come on the programme, we hear about a shift in Japanese train design from Monocle's Asia editor-at-large.
Plus, we talk to Monocle's fashion and design researcher, Jamie Waters, about three brands he's got his eye on this summer.
Tall Stories is a new 5-minute audio snack from the team who bring you The Urbanist each week. In just a few minutes, we talk about one building, one statue, one park bench that has an interesting backstory, something special to reveal to us about life in the city in all shapes and sizes. Sometimes we'll get all historical on you, other times we might be yearning for modernity, but it's 5 minutes of urban diversion, an unplanned journey down the secret side streets of metropolitan life that will, we hope, keep you intrigued. Available every Monday, you can get it by subscribing to The Urbanist via monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes. Be a part of the story.
And now I'm joined in studio by Monocle's intrepid fashion reporter, Jamie Waters, on his birthday, no less. He's about to go out on a shopping spree, but while we have him, he has three fashion finds for us, themed around the next issue of Monocle magazine. Jamie, welcome to the studio. What have you got for us?
Well, I'll start with this pair of shoes that are sitting on my lap. They're actually some of my favourite shoes that I own, and they're from...
So just, sorry to interrupt you there, you've put a pair of shoes on the table, which lots of people consider to be bad luck. As Monocle's fashion voice, has this ever come up? Is this a problem? Shoes on the table? You seem fine with it.
Probably poor etiquette. I think I'm just a bit overexcited because it's my birthday today. So I'm these shoes are from a Swedish label. Basically, the items I've picked today are kind of from quite far-flung places. They might be holiday places or, you know, places we don't necessarily associate with fashion labels. So the shoes are from a brand called Axel Arigato, and it's based in Gothenburg. I'll talk about the actual shoes first, because the thing I like about this brand is that they are offering something a little bit different. You know, we're seeing everyone loves sneakers, and there's a few brands that are tending to dominate the market. These guys are a very new brand, and they're doing something, it's a little bit different. So this particular shoe, they're grey, they're suede. There's a nice sort of detail of stitching in the sides. It's sort of, I'm not quite sure what it is, but a sort of pattern.
And they're kind of trainers, aren't they? So that's a very informal shoe with something, Jamie. You're not a short man, but something of a stacked heel. How do you feel about that?
Yes, and this is one of my favourite parts. So it's got this very sort of high or chunky base, which is white. I like it. I think it gives it a kind of modern edge, and also what guys don't want, to add a bit of height.
Well, you must be 6'1", 6'2". You don't need it, Jamie. You do not need that.
Always
do with a bit more. So moving on to the next item. I think we're in the sunny climes of the Mediterranean, are we? We've got some lovely striped shirts from Mallorca. Tell us more about the brand.
Yeah, so this is a brand called Muse. It's new. I think it was started in 2014.
Muse like someone that might inspire a Greek, or Muse like a row of houses in
London? Muse like a row of houses, okay. M-E-W-S. It was started by a couple of guys from the area who have some really successful menswear boutiques. They're called the Addict Group, is their kind of collection of boutiques. But they've now started an in-house label along with another guy from Paris. The thing I really like about it is Mallorca is one of those places, maybe Hawaii is another one, where there's an amazing sort of shopping scene because popular tourist destination, a lot of money to spend. But I think a lot of shops, you end up having really nice brands, but you could sort of find them in any big city or in any big tourist destination. So I like the fact that there's a sort of a homegrown label doing something that's locally designed, made in Mallorca and in Spain. All their items are sort of designed to be worn by men from age 20 to 80. So these shirts are very loose fitting. They're all cotton. They're very comfortable and casual with sort of these block stripes. And I think basically any guy could throw them on and sort of feel very relaxed. And who wouldn't want to wear that on their holiday, basically?
Yeah, they're really beautiful, nice colours. And I know what you mean about that kind of island culture. Whether fashion needs to be, whether needs to be shipped in to occupy these shops. But it's good to see a bit of manufacturing in Mallorca. So where are we setting sail for next, Jamie?
For the last time, we're heading to Buenos Aires. So
a long journey. I'll need those shirts and those shoes.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe a couple of them.
Buenos Aires is interesting. So for our upcoming issue, we've actually sent a local writer there to sort of report on the retail scene, the fashion scene. Over here, I mean, I think a lot of people don't really know what's sort of happening there. The scene is in some ways quite undercover. So a lot of boutiques are sort of found on tucked away on tree-lined streets.
And lots of appointment-only shops as well, aren't there?
Yeah.
It's less kind of available to the public. But if you know where to go and who to talk to, I think there's a flourishing scene. So what's the name of this brand?
So this brand is called Blue Sheep, and it's by a designer called Cutter Chavan, who I think worked in America for a while and now has just recently launched this women's wear brand. There's a lot of knitwear, so it's like cardigans and ponchos and roll neck sweaters, and it's, again, focused on sort of local wool, so Angora and Merino, Argentinian wools. My pick of the bunch is this, again, quite an oversized piece. It's a jacket, a checked jacket, and it's actually made by the designer's mother from Uruguayan blankets, and it does have a very rustic feel. There's sort of this quite heavy blanket stitching, sort of big cuffs on the sleeves. Mm-hmm. And in a similar way to the brand from Mallorca, I like the fact that this, you feel like if you're shopping in Buenos Aires, you couldn't necessarily get an item like this in other places. So it does have a kind of local flavour to it. And I think that's what you want when you're shopping in a different city. That's a bit sort of off the beaten track, out of the way.
And of course, it is the winter over there in the Southern Hemisphere. So you might need something a bit warmer to keep you feeling cosy. So, Jamie, we have shoes. What's the name of the brand in case people want to look them up?
Axel Arigato.
Some wonderful Muse shirts from Mallorca. And finally from Blue Sheep in Buenos Aires. A lovely throwover. Jamie, thank you so much for your time and happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
It's nearly time to say goodbye, but before we do, let's alight in Japan, a country famous for its long-standing love affair with trains, not least its pointy-nosed, super-fast Shinkansen.
But today, Japanese train designers are rethinking their rolling stock for customers yearning for a more leisurely experience. Monocle's Kenji Hall is here to explain more about how Japanese trains are covering new ground by slowing down.
You know, in Japan, with trains, it's usually about utility and speed and efficiency. It's about moving as many people as possible over the greatest distance in the shortest amount of time. There's this new trend for cruise trains or tourist trains. They go by many names in Japan. But essentially, they're meant to be an immersing journey. They're supposed to be slower than your typical Shinkansen journey. So instead of having, you know, nearly 1,000 seats in one train, they have only enough space for about 34 passengers, and they have dining cars and sleeping quarters, and the level of luxury is far beyond anything that we've seen in Japan. The first train that I looked at is called the Genpi Shinkansen. This is actually a very, very fast train. It's a Shinkansen. And what JR East, the railway operator, JR East, tried to do was the idea of a cafe Shinkansen. Now, having just a cafe wasn't enough, and so they thought of something that would route this particular Shinkansen to the region it was running through, and that's Niigata. Niigata is known for its Echigo Tsumari Art Triennale, and so they figured that if they got a bunch of contemporary artists to produce something for each of the cars on this train, it would bring people to Niigata. It would also be a way of having locals appreciate something that they may or may not appreciate. The Twilight Express Mizukaze, which comes out in the spring of 2017, is really a successor to a train that had existed previously. It was called the Twilight Express, and it had run for 25 years between Osaka and Sapporo. The Twilight Express Mizukaze is a train that was designed by JR West. JR West called on an architect, Kazuya Ura, and a very experienced train designer, Tetsuo Fukuda, to team up for this particular project. Now, if you look at the model, it has this helmet shape to it that is really an homage to the US-made streamliners of the 1930s. It will have wood paneling, it will have lounges and dining cars, and there will be sleeping quarters for about 34 passengers. Lastly, I spoke to Ken Okuyama. Now, this is a man who is known for being a designer of Ferraris and Shinkansen. But what he did for JR East was something entirely different. It's called the Train Suite Shikishima. And it is, similar to these other luxurious trains that have dining cars and sleeping quarters. This one in particular also has a tub made of cypress on board. And they had to come up with all of these technological tricks and technical things that would allow them to put, you know, a bathtub on board a moving train. You imagine when the train rocks or stops or starts, that water is going to slosh around in the tub. They had to create a spillover containment vessel, and they also had to use fins. This was an idea that they took from motorcycle engine design. There are all kinds of innovations that went into these trains. They're not just luxurious sleeper trains.
That was Kenji Hall, Monocle's Asia editor at large.
That's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Alex Funnell, the sound engineer, Toby Hammond, and the birthday boy, Monocle's sartorial sage, Jamie Waters.
Thanks also to Kenji Hall in Tokyo. The show was produced by me, Henry Rhee Sheridan. If you have any comments or queries, then feel free to email me. I'm at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next week at the same time.
You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes. And of course, leave us a review on the latter.
Until next time, it's goodbye from me, Henry Rhee Sheridan.
And I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening to Section D on Monocle 24. And goodbye.